Our next presentation is going to be by Jonathan Rogers on talking about private prosecutions. Jonathan Rogers is an associate professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Cambridge and a fellow of Fitzwilliam College. He's also, as I've already mentioned, a co-director of the Cambridge Centre for Criminal Justice and a co-director of the Criminal Law Reform Network, which is how he's got into his most recent work on talking about private prosecutions. He's particularly well known for his work on prosecutorial discretion and on abusive process, both of which are nicely brought up by the topic of private prosecutions. Jonathan.
Good afternoon, everybody. So as you've probably noticed, I'm not John Spencer, and I was very much hoping he would be here today. He is going to be okay, he wants you all to know. From my point of view, it's quite daunting to step into the shoes of John Spencer, but on the other hand, the format quite suits me as well, because normally when I'm asked to speak at an event, which could be weeks or months away, I say yes, because it's weeks and months away. And then I just do the work the day or the weekend before, you know, doing everything a bit madly and feeling very guilty that I'm not doing the thing any justice. So I'm really pleased to be speaking now at an event where I have the perfect excuse for doing everything at the last minute and the weekend just before. And in any event, it is, of course, for Nikki. Nikki has done not only very much for her subject, but a lot for many of us in this room at a very personal level. Myself, I was an outsider from Cambridge. I may have spent most of my career at University College London, but even in my case, Nikki has helped me a lot. She published various ramblings, which I penned for the Archibald Review many years ago when she was editing that journal. She was on the interview panel when I finally came to Cambridge in 2018, and she also played a role in me joining Fitzwilliam College. Now, it's not essential if you're interested in criminal justice to have an association with Fitzwilliam College, but it does seem to help. I've been very happy there, and I'm particularly pleased that Nikki is still, even in retirement, supervising our students in the subject she loves so much. And another reason why it was quite easy for me just to decide to talk over the weekend was because I saw an opportunity to talk about private prosecutions, which I've been thinking about for quite some years anyway. And I'd better say a few words about our network. So as Finlay mentioned, I'm the co-director of something called the Criminal Law Reform Now Network, which is a body of scholars, legal practitioners and policymakers who just want to improve the criminal law. We don't come from any philosophical or political standpoint. We're open to looking at any area of criminal justice where we think reform is needed. Now, the Law Commission is there to do that, but they can only do so much. They are directed by government to take on or to ignore certain areas of the law, and they only really deal with areas of the law which can be improved by primary legislation. But we, of course, can research what we want and how we want, and we can urge reforms which don't necessarily require legislation. We have actually published a couple of reports already, one on computer misuse in 2020, and just the following year, the then Home Secretary announced a review into the Computer Misuse Act 1990, and we're currently talking to her successors in the Home Office about how that might come about. And we also produced a second report a few months ago on deception in sexual offences. And look here, if you're interested in our work and in joining us, which is free, then I just put our website on the PowerPoint slide. But our biggest project so far has been on private prosecutions, which we started in 2018 and are still working upon. It's proven to be a much bigger topic than we imagined. Well, we imagined it would be big, but it turned out to be even bigger. And this has become newsworthy over the last few years because of the post office scandal. I dare say many of you know about it, but I'll fill you in case you've missed it. The post office scandal concerns a number of prosecutions brought by the post office against its own employees, sub-postmasters in branches of the post office across England, Wales and Scotland. And the post office prosecuted hundreds of its own sub-postmasters for fraud or theft or false accounting all because the software which they insisted be installed in all post office branches, the Horizon software, recorded takings at post office branches, which were nowhere near the amount of money which the sub-postmasters were passing on to the post office. The Horizon software was, of course, faulty and was showing much greater takings than were actually taken. And high up in the post office, there were known problems with the Horizon software, but still they persisted to blame the several postmasters for the shortfalls. And many of these postmasters were investigated internally by the post office's own investigation teams and were then prosecuted internally by the post office's own team of lawyers. And virtually all of them pleaded guilty, even though they were clearly not guilty. And many of them were still sentenced to terms of imprisonment. Only recently has a full story come out. And in June 2020, anticipating lots of quashed convictions from the Court of Appeal, the Justice Select Committee started an inquiry into proper safeguards into improperly brought private prosecutions. And so he gave evidence to them and has spoken to other stakeholders since. Now, I'm going to go on and talk about the conversations we've had, because this is the overall theme of today's conference event. But I'm not ready to talk to you about our conversations just yet. I think a bit more introduction into the world of private prosecutions might assist. First of all, then, our background. We didn't actually know that the post office scandal was brewing in 2018 when we took on the project. We were just more interested in the general theme that you can have private persons enforcing the criminal law. And these could be charities, they could be victims of fraud who find that the police aren't interested in their suffering and they have to find some other way to take action. And this includes some very serious fraud cases. It could be train companies who want to prosecute customers for rail evasion and they want to send the paperwork to any body who is prepared to take on the prosecution for them, in many cases Capita. So private prosecutions come in many shapes and sizes. But one thing which unites all of them is that the state can't afford to do everything it would like to do. The CPS doesn't have enough money to prosecute certain cases. And in any event, the CPS takes on cases which are investigated by the police. So if the police aren't interested in certain offences because they're too difficult or might require specialist knowledge in the case of copyright theft, then the only way to get justice is for companies to start proceedings themselves. And so we're interested in this point about we need law enforcement in these areas too, but are we really prepared to go with the difficulties which come from private enforcement? And wherever you look at it, private enforcement has potential problems. So it can be problematic, for example, that when Capita receive lots of tickets from the railways telling them that X customer has been found travelling on a train without a valid ticket, they have an incentive to prosecute all these cases. They could be very much like the CPS and use a public interest test and weed out most of the minor cases, but they don't have to. They can prosecute how they like. And of course, it's more of a money spinner for them if they do prosecute first. Maybe they can always retreat if the person who's received a summons objects to it. They can always rethink them, but it's much easier just to prosecute first and see what happens. So that's one worrying trend, bulk prosecutions by companies who don't need to apply the same safeguards which a CPS would do. Against that, you also have some boutique law firms who make a lot of money from private prosecutions. Let's suppose somebody has been defrauded of hundreds of thousands of pounds, and yet the police won't investigate it, then they can, if they have the evidence themselves, which they often will, they can take it to a law firm and ask them to prosecute instead. And there are various attractions for this route. As far as the prosecutor is concerned, a prosecution can start. It can go to court. It can even go to court and be unsuccessful. but the prosecutor can still demand a sum of its costs back by virtue of Section 17 of the Prosecution of Offences Act 1985. Those who are not public authorities can always claim costs back from Central Fund in respect of reasonable costs they have incurred during prosecution work, even if they're ultimately unsuccessful. This makes it potentially profitable for would-be private prosecutors who might get some of their costs back after all, and of course for law firms as well. That might make it sound like a bit of a racket, but sometimes these private prosecutions have success stories. We have had a number of serious fraudsters who've been convicted by persons who have prosecuted them privately, and they've been subjected to confiscation orders in excess of £10 million. So the state itself sometimes profit and has no particular disincentive to prevent this sort of work either. I'm still not ready to talk to you about our conversations. I think you need a bit more introduction, because you need to know how private prosecutions can be nipped in the bud in order to understand some of the conversations we've had with our stakeholders. And the post office saga, I think, illustrates the problems reasonably well. One issue about private prosecutions is that the client has control of the prosecution. So the client can instruct their own investigators as well as their own lawyers. And this was, of course, a problem with the post office. The post office, somewhere up there, there were people who knew about the problems with the Horizon software programming because they were paying the company to debug the program on a constant basis. But they never told this to their internal investigation team, and they never told this to their internal prosecution team. So these people just went around, as far as they're concerned, effectively debt collecting from people who must be guilty because the Horizon software said they'd taken all this money, and no one ever told the investigators themselves that the Horizon software was faulty. Naturally, the suspects might have mentioned it at interview, but they were, of course, disbelieved. So that's a potential problem. The client can have too much control of proceedings. And the next problem is that no one outside the post office had any idea how many of their sub-postmasters they were prosecuting on the basis of supposed shortfalls in takings. There seem to have been over 700 people prosecuted in England and Wales and Scotland. Some put the figure even higher. But no one outside the post office knew this. Each postmaster who was individually talked to by the internal investigations team and prosecuted were very much under the impression that they were the only one. And that's not necessarily because the investigators were misleading them. This was a nationwide problem, so there'd be a prosecution in Plymouth or one in Carlisle, one in Nottingham, they're all over the place. So a lot of the internal investigators themselves weren't quite aware of the overall pattern of prosecutions. But the real point is that no official in the Crown Prosecution Service or anyone else or anywhere else had any idea that the post office were prosecuting this sort of offence hundreds of times. Every time the post office went to the magistrate's court to issue a summons to start proceedings, the magistrate would have assumed this was a one-off. They've caught somebody with a hand in the till. And this would have happened hundreds of times over 10 years in magistrates' courts, disparately all across the country, including Scotland, and no one had any sight of the overall picture. And finally, the defendants to these prosecutions were not very proactive themselves, you might think. The one safeguard against inappropriate private prosecutions, well, I tell a lie, there are supposed to be two safeguards against inappropriate private prosecutions. The first is that a magistrate might refuse to issue the summons to get the proceedings underway in the first place, but magistrates are usually given very little information on which they can make such a decision, and it's close to being a rubber stamp exercise, except when Boris Johnson is prosecuted. And the real safeguard is supposed to be the possibility that the Director of Public Prosecutions can take over any prosecution which he himself has not started. And once he's taken it over, he or she can then decide to discontinue it. But this power is actually a relic. It was given to the DPP back in 1879, over 100 years before he had a Crown Prosecution Service to direct. So the power of the DPP to do this is very old, and it was only ever supposed to be used in highly exceptional cases. For example, if the police had promised immunity to an informer, and if somebody else then wanted to prosecute that informer, then the DPP would use its power to take over that prosecution and discontinue it. But it was really meant to avoid conflicts of that nature. It wasn't never intended that the DPP would be the overall custodian of law and order regarding private prosecutions. And so when this provision was reenacted in Section 6(2) of the Prosecution of Offences Act, it was again preserving the ancient power of the DPP to step in and stop any prosecution he didn't like. But it was never supposed to be the case that the DPP would be there at his desk waiting to hear about private prosecutions and willing to react. And this means then that private prosecutors have various advantages. They have almost direct access to our courts. They have potentially generous fees, which might be paid to them from corporate clients, if they have rich corporate clients who wish a fraudster to be prosecuted. They can get a lot of this, and they can get work because a lot of these corporate clients know they might get some of their money back, even if the prosecution is unsuccessful. And we asked around as far as we could. We sent a survey around the International Association of Prosecutors just to find out how common private prosecutions were in other countries, and in particular whether any other country essentially allowed any person direct access to the criminal courts, which is more or less what we have, because the magistrate summons is a rubber stamp thing and the DPP doesn't usually get to hear about private prosecutions, let alone take them over. And what do you think? Do you think we're the only ones? Well, you'd be wrong. It's also possible to have direct access to the criminal courts in Nova Scotia. And it's happened twice. So we are pretty much the only ones, and we do it on an industrial scale. Okay, so that's your lengthy background into what private prosecutions are all about. Now, what have we found out as a network when we try to speak to various stakeholders about what happens on the ground? Well, we found out that it wasn't as easy, essentially, for private prosecutors to go about their business as we thought it was. On paper, and if you read newspaper articles attacking private prosecutions, it all sounds very easy and very lucrative. It's not quite as easy as all that. So we spoke to some private investigators, first of all. And these are generally ex-police officers who have some idea of how to investigate, both in one direction, but also pointing in other directions as well. And they certainly are very accustomed to having their disclosure schedules. And these private investigators would like to work with the official police in all sorts of capacities. Sometimes they need to, of course, if extradition proceedings are in prospect, or if anyone needs to be arrested. But also the police have much more access to very basic information which private investigators need. Now, to begin with, we thought they were just talking about evidence of the actual offences committed. But quite often your private investigators have the evidence of an offence already, but they just need other information in order to start the proceedings. Take, for example, copyright theft. Let's suppose somebody is set up a website and he's streaming films or music and getting money out of it without going through the copyright procedures. That offence can be quite easy to prove. The trouble is, of course, that hundreds of people are doing this and only a few can possibly be prosecuted, even by the Federation Against Copyright Theft. Even they have to choose their battles very carefully. So what they really want to know is exactly how much money is the person running a particular website actually making from the music. And, you know, if it's under 10,000, they'll probably just send a cease and desist letter and hope for the best. But they might go for prosecution if it's tens or hundreds of thousands of pounds. But they actually have no way of knowing. They would need information either from bank statements or from the mobile phone company or the internet service provider. everywhere where this person may be storing his money or every facility he's using to host a website, they won't give any details out to anyone except the police. So the would-be prosecutor needs that information from the police in order to know whether the offence is worth prosecuting. But the police won't actually help them because they don't know whether it's worth their while yet, as you have a chicken and egg situation. There are also financial reasons why nobody wants to be the prosecutor, particularly in cases of serious fraud. If you have somebody who's defrauded somebody of several hundreds of thousands of pounds, or millions of pounds in some cases, then the first thing you're going to want to do is actually get a freezing order to secure the assets before you go any further. That's already a problem because it may be too early for some private prosecutors to do that. But an additional problem is that restraining or freezing orders are very cumbersome. They often have to be put in place very quickly, and they can be challenged by third parties as well as by the defendant themselves. So if you do manage to freeze £5 million of a fraudster, what may then happen is that his wife will divorce him or try to divorce him the next month. And then she'll go to the family court asking for that money to be unfrozen. And so your private prosecutor will then go and have to defend that. And as some of our respondents said to us, freezing orders are a pain. They take a lot of looking after. You've got to look after them on an almost monthly basis until the trial. And they're not easy to obtain, and they can only be obtained through the civil courts. And that means that the prosecutor won't get his costs back if he loses. Indeed, if the prosecutor tries to freeze someone's assets and fails, then he pays the costs of the other side. This is the difference between civil proceedings and criminal proceedings. And they often have a case where the private prosecutor would quite like the CPS or the SFO to be the prosecutor and take on that work, whilst the SFO and CPS would much rather they do it. And you can imagine that conversation. I said, well, you're the victim. I mean, really, we think you should do it. Yes, but you just said it's in the public interest. What they lack is a clear way of sharing the costs and sharing the risk. Something else we learned refers back to the problem I mentioned a moment ago, that the best way in theory of stopping an inappropriate private prosecution is to get the DPP to take it over and discontinue it. And we assumed that happened an awful lot. In fact, it happens very rarely. They probably only receive about 50 applications per year. And, you know, given that probably thousands of people are privately prosecuted every year, it's a very, very small sum. And as I said, or alluded to a moment ago, none of the defendants to the post office prosecutions actually did alert the DPP to the prosecution which they were facing, even though they knew they were innocent. So why do so few people actually grab the lifeline, potentially, of going for the DPP? It's free, after all. You don't have to pay the DPP. You just write a letter saying, I'm being prosecuted by this company in this court. Please take it over and discontinue it. Well, one reason, of course, is that a lot of defendants are ignorant of the possibility of doing so, and the CPS is extremely unwilling to advertise it. As I said already, it doesn't actually see it having a major role in dealing with private prosecutions. It was set up to take over prosecutions where the police had investigated. That's what it's for, stuff which the police do. It's not in its own eye there to deal with other prosecutions. And I can talk later on about the CPS being unwilling to advertise it, but they are unwilling to advertise the possibility of taking over proceedings. But what we didn't realise was that a lot of defence lawyers, who are, of course, aware of the possibility, still do not advise their clients to go down this route. And this can be for one or of more or many reasons. One reason is that if a prosecution seems in their eyes to have a good chance of success, then they don't want the CPS to be alerted, because not only will they probably not take over the prosecution, there's also the risk that even if they do take over the prosecution, they might then decide to continue it themselves. And then there'll be no risk of the prosecutor, of the private prosecutor, running out of money. You see, the private prosecutor can get his funds back from central funds later down the line, but there's always a risk he'll run out of money first. So some defendants, if they think that the prosecution is soundly based, do actually not want the CPS to become alerted to it. Another point is that defence lawyers may think they have a good chance of relying upon abuse of process if the case does get to trial, if they're being privately prosecuted. They'll say that the private prosecutor hasn't acted fairly, he's not disclosed things properly, or they say he has ulterior motives, or they'll say that this is really a civil dispute and this person is trying to abuse a process of the criminal courts by instigating criminal proceedings instead. They can try all these abuse arguments. They don't often succeed, but they can try. And they always feel that they have a chance of persuading a soft judge on a good day if it's a private prosecutor, because they can build in, they can buy into these cliches about ulterior motives and so on. So the last thing they want is either for the CPS to have taken it over and to become the prosecutor themselves, nor do they even want the CPS to have been referred to the prosecution, because if the CPS allows a private prosecutor to continue, then that might appear to a judge when hearing abuse of process as though the DPP has stamped it off as being, this looks okay to us. So they'd much rather that they fight the prosecution through abuse of process in court without any kind of stamp of approval from any official source. And finally, even if your defence lawyer doesn't want to refer it to the CPS before trial and to try to have it stopped through abuse of process, if he fails in that abuse of process hearing, he can still refer it to the DPP for possible takeover, even when the trial is about to start. I wouldn't have thought this was possible, but it is, and it has happened. I suppose you might think the CPS would refuse to look at taking over a trial that is just about to begin, but I suppose your defendant to a private prosecution can always say, oh, well, yes, we weren't going to ask you to do this, but then we just received this final bit of disclosure from the prosecutor last week and it changes everything. And you can imagine how they would try that on. And so trials have been delayed on that basis too. So it turns out that privately prosecuting is not an easy course after all, and it's far less efficient than it might be in many respects. Now, I haven't got a final PowerPoint slide, and that's quite appropriate because we haven't reached a conclusion of our project yet either. We can and will suggest various amendments to the criminal procedure rules and to the costs regime, and we will suggest ideas, whether or not they'll be welcome is another matter, regarding CPS policy on takeovers as well. But what we're really getting from our work on private prosecutions is that if we're going to make serious improvements rather than, you know, cutting around the edges and trimming a little bit, then some serious conversations need to be had about the role of the private sector in criminal law enforcement. We do need to be able to encourage talented investigators and prosecuting lawyers who are good, who are not currently working for the CPS but who are nonetheless good at what they do. We need to find some way for them to actually work for the public good. We need to find some way for investigators of serious frauds to have greater cooperation from the police and for them to be some kind of official arrangements with the prosecuting services regarding costs so that the risks are fairly spread in the overall public interest. We might, for some prosecutors, like Capita, for example, need some kind of inspection regime as well. All of this means that there's a lot more talking to be done, and more powerful people than we will need to be done to do that. A government, perhaps the next government, will need to be serious about looking at private stroke public enterprise and forcing people to talk to each other more than they have been. So this, from our point of view, is a long-term project. I think that when I retire in the 2030s, I'll still be researching it, and you can introduce me when I do that, Findlay. But in the meantime, it's a great pleasure to talk at Nikki's event. Thank you very much.